Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to the panel. This one is called Challenges to Campus Free Speech and Academic Freedom. So you know you're in the right spot. Let me give you a little bit of an overview of the format that we've decided upon for today and introduce briefly our speakers, and then we'll get started. So the format is I will make some very brief introductions, each of our speakers, and we will go in order according to how they're printed on the program. Each of our speakers will have 10 minutes to make some statements, and then we will open it up to questions. We would like to limit questions to no more than 2 minutes so that we have enough time to have as many different commentaries and questions as possible. Okay. Well, they have 10 minutes each.
I mean, during Q&A.
Sorry?
During Q&A.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Thank you.
We're all stuck there. All right, so let me make some introductions. First, I'll introduce myself. I'm Hertha Sweet Wong. I'm an associate professor in the Department of English and chair of the Department of Art Practice here at Berkeley. My focus, my little research.
What department? I didn't hear you.
Art practice. People who make art. Okay, and my focus is on indigenous literatures, autobiography, and visual studies, especially focusing on critiquing visual and verbal regimes. And in the past few years, I've been doing some work on the parallels between Native North American and Palestinian experiences of colonization and settlement. I'm now going to introduce our panelists in alphabetical order. So first is Celeste Langan. She's my colleague and an associate professor in the Department of English here at UC Berkeley. Her primary field is Romanticism, but she's also written on essays on mobility disability, essays that explore the conceptual relation between the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s and disability rights, and on the relation of poetry to the reign of information. At the time that she was serving as acting director of the Townsend Center for the Humanities, Celeste was arrested and charged for participating in the Occupy Cal event. She was also pretty much mauled by the police in 2011. Greg Lukianoff, right here, is an attorney and the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE. He is the author of Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate and Freedom from Speech. His writing has been published in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, the Boston Globe, Forum, Reason, and numerous other publications. Greg frequently appears on TV shows and radio programs, including the CBS Evening News, the Today Show, and NPR's Radio Times. This is Greg. Hank Reichman, if I said that right.
My Republican brother gave me a sneak preview of you. The only thing one of the few things I and he agree on is free speech.
Okay, so let me proceed with introductions, and we can pick that up in the question and answer, if there is a question. Hank is a professor emeritus of history at California State University East Bay, as well as the first vice president of the American Association of University Professors. He is also the chair of the AAUP's Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. An activist in SDS at Columbia during the student rebellion there in 1968, he went on to earn his PhD in history at Berkeley under the direction of the late and much beloved Reggie Zelnick. Since 1980, he has edited the American Library Association's semi-monthly newsletter on intellectual freedom and is the author of books and articles on Russian and Soviet history, academic freedom, and university governance. In 2008, he was nominated by the Academic Senate of CSU to serve as the sole California State University faculty trustee, but then Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger refused to make any appointment. Hank would also like us to mention that his late mother was one of Mario Savio's high school teachers at Martin Van Buren High School in Queens, New York. And finally, Yaman Salahi, on the far end, is a staff attorney in the National Security and Civil Rights Program at the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco, an affiliate of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. In partnership with other civil rights groups, the Asian Law Caucus has responded to a wave of attacks on student expression and academic freedom across California, particularly as they relate to discussion about the Middle East. Iman obtained a bachelor's degree in rhetoric from UC Berkeley and graduated from Yale Law School. So please join me in welcoming our speakers, and we'll start with Hank.
Good afternoon, everybody. I want to start by thanking the organizers of this fantastic event for inviting me to participate. It's really an honor and a privilege. I was a high school student in New York during the FSM, but it's always sort of been there for me as some kind of indirect influence on my life when I was a student at Columbia and took part in the student rebellions there in the 1960s. When I finally came to Berkeley 5 years after the FSM, and where I got to know, of course, Reggie Zelnick and others who were involved in the FSM. So I really feel it's an honor and a privilege to be part of this celebration. I want to talk today about academic freedom, which is distinct, I think, from the broader freedom of speech that is enjoyed by citizens or that is maybe enjoyed by students on campus. When people ask, what is academic freedom? I have a rather arrogant but simple answer. Academic freedom is what AAUP says it is. And by that, I don't mean that in any given controversy, a stance that AAUP may or may not take is the correct one, but that the principles of academic freedom have been defined in the United States largely by the American Association of University Professors, which was founded on January 1st, 1915 in New York, and hence is about to celebrate its centennial year. AAUP in 1915, among its first actions, was to issue its 1915 Statement on Academic Freedom and Academic Tenure. That provided the basic definition of the concept of academic freedom, which has since been embraced throughout the profession. In 1940, AAUP and the American Association of American Colleges, now the Association of American Colleges and Universities, jointly formulated the 1940 Statement on Academic Freedom and Tenure, which is an elaboration of the 1915 Statement, and some would argue, by the way, a bit of a step backward from it because it was a joint publication of the AAUP and an association of university trustees and presidents, but nonetheless has become kind of the gold standard of what is academic freedom for faculty in the United States. The statement has now been endorsed by almost 300 professional organizations, disciplinary associations, etc., throughout the United States. It appears in probably hundreds, but certainly dozens of faculty handbooks, collective bargaining agreements, and other policy manuals of universities and colleges throughout the United States. According to the 1940 Statement, academic freedom has three fundamental elements. First is the freedom of research, the freedom of the faculty to pursue research in areas of the faculty members' own choosing, and to control the results of that research. The second is the freedom to teach, the freedom of the faculty member to teach his or her subject matter as he or she sees professionally fitting, without outside interference or observation. Those two freedoms, by the way, are founded less upon classic First Amendment principles than they are upon the principles of professional autonomy, that faculty hold the right to freedom of research and freedom to teach by virtue of their special training and background and their qualifications to be researchers and teachers. The third element of academic freedom, however, is much more closely related to the First Amendment and to the general freedom of speech, and that is what we call the freedom of extramural expression. Extramural meaning simply outside the walls. The freedom of faculty members to speak as citizens on any subject that they may have opinions upon about without fear of consequences, disciplinary consequences, by the university. In other words, their speech should be subject to nothing else than the things that general public is subject to under the First Amendment, which are very few limits. In recent years, AAUP has tended to add what we always thought was an implicit element in these three, but now need to make explicit, at least for public universities, which is the freedom of intramural expression, freedom of expression within the walls of the university when faculty members wish to speak on matters of university policy, that they should have the right to speak, whether in a formal capacity as a department chair, as an elected faculty representative on a senate, etc., or simply as an individual faculty member. And this is extremely important because in 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Garcetti v. Ceballos decision ruled that public employees, when speaking as part of their duties as an employee, are not protected by the First Amendment. At the time, Justice Souter raised a question as to what this would mean for public university professors. The court said they didn't have to deal with that yet. But as a result, lower courts have taken different views. Fortunately, here in the Ninth Circuit, they've ruled that Garcetti does not apply to faculty speech. But there have been cases where faculty members universities have sought to punish faculty members for speech, for instance, complaining about the lack of diversity among the faculty or complaining about over-reliance on part-time faculty. And there have been consequences for their speech, and that had been ruled by courts to be unprotected. So that's a fourth element. The AAUP has continued, of course, to issue large numbers of policy statements. We're famous for it. Famous Red Book, AAUP Policy Documents and Reports, is a compilation of them. This is the 10th 2006 edition, but I can tell you that a brand new revised centennial edition will be coming out in January of 2015. So these are now dated, but if you really want a copy, there are tons sitting in my garage. Talk to me later. We're happy to get rid of them. But I do want to point out to one statement that we did that is in that book that will be in the next version as well, is the 1967 Joint Statement on Rights and Freedoms of Students. It was put together by a committee of representatives from the AAUP, the U.S. National Student Association, now called the U.S. Student Association, the Association of American Colleges, and several other organizations. Endorsed by each of those organizations, it outlined student rights and freedoms. It remains to this day a prescient and excellent document, and frankly, I cannot imagine it having been written in 1967 had not the students at Berkeley done what they had done in 1964 during the free speech movement. Now, I want to talk for the rest of my time about some current challenges to academic freedom of the faculty, talk a little bit about the question of civility, and then if there's time, and I hope there will be, to talk about an experience which I've had that I think illustrates some of the contradictions and conflicts we face in free expression on campus. One of the main areas in which there are new challenges to academic freedom is been with the rise of social media. In Kansas, after one of those mass shootings, I think it was the one at the Washington Naval Yard, a journalism professor tweeted something that this should be on the NRA. What if their children had been killed? And there was a big – Kansas is a pretty conservative place. There was a big – may it be your kids next. That was the – and there was a big brouhaha. And this prompted the Board of Regents of the Universities of Kansas to put together a new social media policy, which was a policy that basically said that any faculty member or employee who basically said anything they didn't – I'm being crude here – but said anything they didn't like could be punished, even fired – if they said it on social media, which they defined as including email and basically any form of electronic communication. The policy was developed without any faculty consultation, heck, without any administrative consultation as well. They have since backtracked a bit, but it's still there. And then there's, of course, what is probably right now the biggest academic freedom case in the country, the case of Stephen Salida. And let me just look. How many people have heard of the Salida case? Not everybody, so I'll give you a very brief rundown. Stephen Salida was hired last October by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign to a tenured position in Native American Studies, American Indian Studies, excuse me, and was supposed to start with the fall term in 2014. He resigned his former position. He got all sorts of emails about orientations, about his class assignment for the next year, etc. Was about to move to Urbana when on August 1st he got a letter from the chancellor of the university stating that his appointment was pending approval by the Board of Trustees, and she had decided not to send it to the Board of Trustees. The reason being that over the previous months, Salida had issued a number of very controversial tweets about the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Well, to make a long story short, and it's a story that is still continuing, all hell broke loose. And we in the AAUP are extremely concerned about this. We sent a very long letter of concern to the administration. We believe this is essentially a summary dismissal, that his appointment was, for all intents and purposes, real. And he should have been, if he had done something wrong, he was entitled to due process hearing. But we don't see anything that he did wrong, except maybe said some things that some people didn't like. There's now also evidence that this was in response to pressure from donors. The Salida case, of course, shows that not only is social media an issue, but controversial expression everywhere is an issue. And indeed, at Illinois itself, there's another case I think just as important in some respects is the case of James Kilgore. Kilgore, as a young man, had been a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Some of the older folks around here will remember them from the 1970s. And then went into exile under an assumed name in South Africa, ended up getting an advanced degree, I believe a PhD, wrote several novels, very highly received novels, eventually turned himself in, served 6 years in prison. When he came out, he joined his wife, who is now a tenured professor at the University of Illinois, and he was offered a job position as a part-time non-tenure-track faculty member teaching the English department. At his very first interview, he turned to the dean and said, "Have you Googled me?" Because he didn't want them to, you know, not know who he was. And they go, "Yeah, we know who you are. It's okay." And for 6 years, he taught until the local newspaper published an article exposing who he had been, and he was fired. The chair of the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois, Chris Kennedy, son of late Robert Kennedy, stated that, he's not tenured, so he doesn't have academic freedom. He does, certainly as the AAUP defines it. So I'm going to skip a number of the things I was going to say. And I'm going to, because I only have 2 more minutes, I'm going to talk about the story I was going to tell. This is a bit of a jump from what I was talking about and skipping over a lot of what I thought I was going to cover, but I don't understand how time flies. And here's the story. A few years ago, Mark Rudd, who was the leader of the Columbia Student Rebellion of 1968, published a memoir. And Mark, of course, had been a member of the famous Weather Underground. Mark's memoir is highly self-critical of his years in the Weather Underground, and he was doing a book tour, and I invited him to speak at my campus. We've known each other since we were freshmen at Columbia together, and he came to speak, and we had gotten a request in advance from, I believe it was Pacifica, if they could film his speech. They set up a big camera just facing him. I come to the speech. First thing I discover is on every single chair is a list of 40 questions for Mark Rudd. They're questions that make "Do you still beat your wife" sound like reasonable ones. They're basically from people, it turns out, retired San Francisco police officers and some others who believe, whether rightly or wrongly, I cannot say, that Mark Rudd is implicated in the killing of a police officer in San Francisco in the 1970s. I take these leaflets off the chairs, and they say, "Free speech." And I go, whoa. Stand outside the door and hand them to everybody who comes in. I don't care. Put them on the table. But I can't have them on the table because it looks like these are the official questions of the organizers. So they grumble. They don't hand them out. Then I notice that they have a handheld video camera. Well, I'd given Pacifica permission to video, so I had to give them permission. I was by the way, in charge of this event. Mark comes, he walks down the aisle, and a guy comes, turns to him and says, "Mark, you remember me?" And he goes, "No, I don't." He goes, "I'm Larry Grathwall." Well, Larry Grathwall was the only undercover police agent to penetrate the Weather Underground, and he had turned in several people, and there's a long account of it in Mark's book. So we know we're in for an interesting hour or so. And these guys are constantly interrupting the speech, yelling things, etc. Soon word gets out and four campus police officers arrive. Sergeant, who I know well, says to me, he says, "Professor Eichmann," he goes, "you want me to kick these guys out?" So I go, "No, I want free speech. I want there to be, as long as there's dialogue, we can keep it under control." It's getting a little heated. And they're doing this, they're turning the camera on the audience as well as the speaker. And so it's intimidating people from speaking because they don't know who these people are. Eventually, Mark handles it very well, by the way. At the end, he reads the portion of his book about Larry Grathwall and then invites Larry Grathwall to the podium to give his side of the story. And it ended up okay. But I had to make a lot of quick decisions about free speech, something I've been advocating my entire life. And at that moment, did I let them? Was I right to take those off the seats? Or did I impact their free speech? I think I was right, but I didn't have a time to discuss it or debate it or bring it before the AAUP National Council. Should I have asked the police to intervene? At what point would it have been fine for the police to intervene? What if violence had broken out before the police intervened? As it was, it worked out right, but it made me realize how difficult some of these issues can be, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay, so as Hertha suggested, I'm here primarily as a victim, not as an expert. So in 2011, during Occupy Cal, which was entirely organized by Berkeley students, I was a kind of passive participant. As you may know, we were linking arms, and the police had been given instructions to get the tents, presumably because the tents were a threat to a clear and present danger to health and safety. So they came with batons and yanked the person who was in front of me away, and then I only had one linked arm, so I put the other one out and said, "Well, arrest me," thinking that this, I have to say that I'm a legacy of the free speech movement. I went to millions of demonstrations with my parents. My mother and father were getting arrested well into their 70s at various anti-nuclear demonstrations at the School of the Americas, et cetera, and they would be arrested quite courteously, right? Put your hands behind with the little plastic cuffs, led away. So that's what I was expecting. And the reason I tell you this is because we're talking about the question of free speech and protest today, and the militarization of police response is something that I think we really have to talk about. So I want to talk not only about the Salita case, but also about Ferguson. What happens when police are asserting a kind of threat to public safety every time people assemble in protest? Anyway, so just to make the story fairly short, I was, instead of somebody putting the handcuffs on me, they pulled me by my hair and made me get down to the ground and then handcuffed me while I was on my belly. And then they said, "Get up." And I want people who always say, do what the police tell you, to try that, to be prone on the ground with your hands behind your back and to try to get up. I mean, some athletes could do it, but I was having trouble. So the other thing that I was surprised by and has never really been explained by the police is that after this occurred, I was sitting in the basement of Sproul, some of you may have been there, and waiting for the other 200 people who were there to come as well. But there were only six of us arrested. And the police had never a plan for mass arrests, despite their, you know, having already called in the mutual aid of the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. So their new way of dealing with a mass civil disobedience is selectively to target people with violence and then let the other people disperse as they will. So this is the police have never explained why they did not have a plan for mass arrest. They just said, well, we didn't have the buses. Okay, and then a couple of other, just one other thing about that incident that seems relevant to the issue of civility. The five other people with whom I was arrested went to the Berkeley City Jail, and one of the student protesters, very agitated, kept on addressing the Alameda County Sheriff's Officer who was guarding us as bitch, right? And the other woman and I said, you know, don't do that, right? You know, that's an insult to us, right? And so I do think the issue of civility is relevant, but I think that's the way to handle it, right? You know, you have a diverse group of people who can police themselves, as Occupy did very well. Okay, so let's move on. I should say, as Hertha said, I'm a kind of obscure scholar in romantic poetry, although I do the French Revolution. So, but after I was arrested, I wrote a blog account of the arrest, and it was read by more people than have ever read anything I've written on Wordsworth. And recently, because you may have heard that the new chancellor... So, of course, the reason I wrote that blog is partly because I was so upset that my chancellor would have described what I did and the other students as not nonviolent, since I stood still and offered myself to be arrested. And so that's what I wrote against. This is what I want to bring to your attention as well. The Berkeley Faculty Association, of which I am a member and which is actually the only activist faculty body on campus, wrote a statement recently about our new chancellor's statement about civility, in which they distinguish the threat to academic freedom and free speech now from 1964. In 1964, the major threat was Sacramento, a kind of Cold War political fear of communism, etc. Now that the state has disinvested, the threat is privatization. And the way privatization makes itself felt as a threat in many, many ways. One thing is the administrative bloat of this university. So over the last 20 years, Charlie Schwartz has done statistical study. The administration, senior management, has grown by 251%, whereas employees in general have grown by 51%. And now senior administrators outnumber faculty by some like 9,500 to 8,600. This, as a consequence, there is very little contact between faculty and administration. So it's partly as a consequence, we get these tone deaf messages from chancellors that are administrative speech that reflect no dialogue with faculty or students or a kind of respect for current ideas of what constitutes civility. The other thing, of course, and this is a much more subtle threat to academic freedom, has to do, again, with the disinvestment in public organs of communication. So that I was just at a merit and promotion meeting yesterday in which one of my colleagues was suggesting that a book ought to take one direction because it would be more likely to be picked up by a publisher, right? So all of a sudden, what is relevant for research and teaching is being judged as a commodity, that, and the value of the commodity is being determined not by academic institutions, academic presses, but increasingly by, they're still academic presses, but they're now more attentive to the bottom line because they have been unfunded. So that's what I wanted to bring to your attention, the militarization of police response to civil disobedience and the way in which our universities are increasingly administered as businesses, which brings us back to the issue of, you know, whether we are regarded as academics or as employees. And I'll stop there. I have more to say, but that's fine. Okay?
Hey, Greg.
My name is Greg Lukianoff. I'm just going to give you a little bit of my personal background because I went to – it's kind of funny. I went to Stanford for law school, but I'm from the East Coast, and I was really shocked at how much it mattered to people both from Berkeley and Stanford about this rival we were supposed to have, which I've never felt at all. I was always like, oh, Berkeley's a great school. And I have a lot of friends who taught here. So this is kind of like where I worked for the ACLU of Northern California. I took every class that Stanford offered on First Amendment law. I even made up 6 credits on censorship during the Tudor dynasty. This was my passion. This is why I went. And I had a big knowledge of the history of censorship. And I have to tell you, I am routinely and on a daily basis shocked by how easy it is to get in trouble on the modern college campus, particularly for students. And it's interesting because definitely the Salita case is political. It's sexy. It definitely has this sort of like political valence with a lot of people on campus and fire have been involved in it from the start, but it's also one of just so many cases I've seen over the years. So I want to give you, but I think I was invited out actually. I think I got the attention of the organizers because I actually wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal about that sort of mealy mouse civility statement that Chancellor Dirks came out with. I was reading that on a Friday night and I was just like, this is also terrible writing. And it could. I wrote that, but basically, like the limitations were basically kind of like you can't have free speech if anyone doesn't feel respected or safe, and it's just kind of like no, that's not the way it works. But it's interesting because it turned into a bigger debate on the internet about civility. I see a role for civility. Don't get me wrong. I think one of the most important things is hearing other people out. But when someone in power starts giving these really vague principles about what civility means to him, and I know that university presidents abuse this power all the time, it definitely was like, I'm going to have to address this. So I'm glad that it walked it back quite a bit in his later statement. But anyway. So I just want to give you some examples, you know, of where I feel like we've come from the free speech movement to today, and you know, particularly from studying the history of it and talking to a lot of different people. I think there might have been like a perfect week in 1977, maybe a month when free speech was perfectly protected on college campuses. I don't know, somewhere in between, because in the 80s you started having the rise of sort of what and I don't like this term very much, but what could be called politically correct speech codes. And then you also had the rise of the administrative university. The massive expansion of the administrative class is a very most of what I've been fighting over the last 13 years at FIRE have been mid-level administrators trying to tell students and faculty what they can get away with. And I want to give you some examples because it's important to put some meat on the bones here and why it's like, yes, Salita is a sexy case and we're involved in it. But last year we had 3 different cases involving two different student groups that were trying to hand out copies of the U.S. Constitution, who were stopped at one at Modesto Junior College, and that student, by the way, was stopped on Constitution Day. And he got the whole thing on video. And it's funny because, like, we try to explain these stories to people, but it's this hyper-bureaucratization. Like, so what they ended up, so a campus police officer comes up to him and starts explaining, well, you have to be a registered student group. And he's like, I am handing out the Constitution. Well, you have to get permission to use the free speech zone on campus. Y'all know about free speech zones, right?
They don't
These things are all over the state of California, and they're absolutely absurd. So we had this case. We actually had to go to court to fight Modesto Junior College to explain to them that you can't tell. And, oh, by the way, this was a nice student, so we actually went to the administrator and asked for permission to hand out constitutions. And the administrator, I felt bad for this person, and essentially was sort of a cog in this weird machine, but bringing out this folder, you know, saying, well, you know, sorry, you can't hand out constitutions on Constitution Day because someone's using the free speech zone right now, so maybe sometime in October? But by the way, Constitution Day is September 17th. So just, it, and I mean, like, I think Orwellian is thrown around very lightly, but the stuff I see on campuses. Okay, so I'm just doing California cases, right? But I have so many examples of these. I mean, I just came out with a book 2 weeks ago called Freedom From Speech, which is where I'm afraid we're headed. We had another case at Citrus College where a student was told that he could not get a petition signed protesting NSA spying outside of the free speech zone. I mean, like a weird confluence of two different sort of nightmarish scenarios sort of helping each other out. They might have been high-fiving each other in some way. University of Hawaii, Hilo, another case. And this actually combined both situations. University of Hawaii at Hilo, it's University of Hawaii. First, students were told that they couldn't approach students, they couldn't approach their fellow students to hand them copies of the Constitution. And then when they were trying to protest, and you guys are going to love this, when they were trying to protest the NSA later on, they were told they had to go into the little free speech zone, which I've seen at Hilo. It's this, like, little swamp. Far away from everybody else that tends to flood and has this electrical panel right in the middle. And I'm like, wow, okay, so you also want to get them electrocuted. But okay, this is what the administrators told the students at Hilo when they were just trying to protest the freaking NSA. You can't just go around talking about that everywhere. It's not the 60s anymore. Yeah, and I always like to, and so this was one of the things that inspired us to launch a lawsuit, a series of lawsuits against university speech codes. We survey universities. We rate them according to red, yellow, and green. Green light universities have no speech codes. They have nothing that in any way implicates Constitution or First Amendment values. Yellow light are, you know, possibly ones that could be challenged in court. It's more like depends on how they're applied, but they're vague enough that we think they could lose. And red light are ones that are laughably unconstitutional. And I want to make this point. Every single code we have rated a red light in our entire history has been overturned by a court in a challenge or abandoned by the school. We have 100% success rate on these things. But right now, Berkeley is actually a yellow light school. It has a couple pretty bad policies. I mean, not as yellow light. And this is you got to kind of take it the way you have it, and understand that 58% of public colleges that we survey have red light speech codes. So having yellow light speech codes is not that bad. But but if you go to thefire.org, you can see the letter that we just sent to Berkeley to try to get them to be a green light school, because we would like that. Thefire.org, and it's right at the top of the website right now, the letter where we're, and it, you know, so some of it's just the normal bureaucratic stuff, like flyers must be submitted to residential living for approval at least 5 working days prior to requested posting date, and must not allude to drugs. And I love this because we're always writing schools saying, so normal can't be on your campus. You can't have a drug legalization. And we have a case right now at Iowa State University where they were trying to tell it's basically every ridiculous scenario you can come up with, I've actually dealt with at some point or another. And at Iowa State University, they were told normal that they could not have a pot leaf on a T-shirt because that would, quote unquote, promote drug use. And you have to explain what normal actually stands for and what the whole point of the organization is. So we're suing them, too. But it really ends up being really quite surreal because a lot of these codes are passed, you know, some of them are passed out of just this sort of like zombie-like application of rules. That's how you end up with the speech zones. Some of them are justified, you know, under the sort of nice-sounding, sort of noble-sounding idea of banning hate speech. But I have to tell you, 99 times out of 1,000, the kind of stuff that is getting people in trouble on college campus is stuff that the average American, the average you know, free speech movement person wouldn't even bat an eye at. Okay, now, just another example just from this year. How many people know Game of Thrones? Yeah, I love the show. Daenerys Targaryen, the true hero of the show, she has a quote at one point when she's deciding to take back her kingdom, saying, "I will take what is mine with blood and fire." This is a great empowering moment for Daenerys. This is a big favorite quote among fans of the show. And a professor at Bergen County College had this quote on a T-shirt, and he took a picture of his daughter, his like 6-year-old daughter, wearing this T-shirt, posted it on Google+, and he was suspended from teaching and sentenced to mandatory counseling because an administrator saw this T-shirt and, of course, naturally assumed it must be a threat upon his life. And that's not the only case I have like that. I have a case involving a Firefly quote, and there's a case in the 11th Circuit right now that we've been fighting. It's the opening story of my book, Unlearning Liberty, my previous book, where a student was literally kicked out of school for a collage protesting a parking garage. Now, the good news about that case is that we actually got we pierced qualified immunity. So the university president is being held personally liable, at least in theory. This is going before the 11th Circuit. We're hoping that they're really going to stick it to him. But I just wanted to give you a little update. Things are pretty rough for free speech on college campuses these days. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Yaman.
Yep. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Your talk got me thinking that there's this circle in the middle of Sproul Plaza that has a very noble statement around it about how there's no laws over. I'm wondering if that's the only free speech zone left on campus.
We actually have it in here. Really? We're saying that the free speech zone at Berkeley is not good enough.
That's funny.
Not a red light, but a yellow light. You guys should be green.
Well, thank you for having us here today and for organizing the panel and inviting me to participate. I'm mostly going to focus on providing more information about how free speech issues have played out with respect to speech on campus, both by students and faculty with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I'll try as much as possible to separate what I think is questions about the merits of the debate and what side is right, what side is wrong, from questions about the right to have that debate in the first place. And I think that's the real thing that matters when you talk about freedom of speech and academic freedom. So, and I want to use as many vivid examples as I can of what's actually going on in this arena. So in 2012, a UC Berkeley alumna filed a lawsuit against the university, claiming she had faced illegal discrimination as a Jewish student because the university had failed to protect her against a hostile educational environment. According to this student, the university tolerated events by the Muslim Student Association and by Students for Justice in Palestine, which criticized the State of Israel and the occupation of Palestine. In particular, the student sought a judicial order forbidding events called mock checkpoints, where students wear military costumes and try to dramatize military checkpoints in the West Bank. I'm going to read a paragraph from the lawsuit that I think is very important. The student said, her experiences at the 2009 and 2010 checkpoints were terrifying and demeaning in extreme degrees. She describes the frenzy of those military uniforms and carrying realistic assault weapons. The soldiers holding realistic assault weapons and other participants shouted and yelled at passing students, "Prepare to be stopped. What is your religion?" The first time she was stopped, she was absolutely terrified. No one before had ever stopped her while carrying an assault rifle and yelling. She was ashamed. She was terrified for weeks. I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't start this out by pointing out what I think is an important kernel of political truth in that image, which is here you have student activists who are trying to enact a drama to highlight their point of view on a political issue, and someone who disagrees with their point of view is saying that the drama is so terrifying that it should be banned from campus. Well, you really have to ask yourself, what about the real thing? And I think that it's important to situate this particular free speech debate within the context of a growing social movement in the United States. That's what's raising these issues. That is being more critical of the Israeli occupation. It's being more critical of U.S. foreign policy in this issue. And so it's provoking more debates about what is appropriate, what is not appropriate. These people are confronting deeply entrenched ideas in American society and political system. And I think that's the backdrop to realize where these are coming up. But complaints like this are actually prototypical of what we've been seeing on campuses around the country with respect to this issue. There were three federal investigations by the U.S. Department of Education against UC Berkeley based on that complaint, against UC Santa Cruz, against UC Irvine, all based on essentially the same claim, which is that because of events on campus that feature criticism of the Israeli government or of U.S. policy towards the Middle East, people, based on their identity, Jewish students, would feel uncomfortable on campus or would feel that there was a hostile educational environment. And this discourse has even played out and has had an effect in terms of getting administrators to censor speech in general or to punish students, even short of legal complaints and legal filings. So in March of this year, a student organization at Columbia University received permission to use a shared banner space, and they posted a banner that said, "Stand with justice, stand with Palestine," and there was a graphic depicting a 1948 map of what was then Palestine, pre-partition. And at that point, people on campus complained that the map itself was offensive and threatening, and that's the words that they used, and that because it can be deeply threatening to many Jewish students. Barnard actually removed the banner, and this is actually what I think is important as to the effects that this can have on free speech on campus in the long term. They've now no longer opened up that banner space to anyone to post anything as they revise the policy, and that's been in use for decades. So it's important to notice that this is not just about this issue, but has ramifications beyond this particular issue. In May of this year, a student group at New York University leafleted 2,000 dorms with mock eviction notices. So these are very clearly fake notices that say something like, "You're being evicted from your dorm," and then go on to talk about home demolitions in the occupied West Bank. So they're meant to highlight their political view about that situation. And similar tactics have been employed at Harvard, Yale, Florida Atlantic University, the University of Chicago, and probably most notoriously Northeastern University. But these have also prompted similar complaints that the notices themselves are disrespectful and intimidating, and they make students feel attacked, threatened, and unsafe on the basis of their identity. Northeastern University actually ended up suspending a student organization for distributing these tactics on the technicality that they violated a rule about leafleting in the dorms. But it was after a tremendous amount of backlash from groups, including FIRE and a number of people involved in FIRE, that the university was forced to reinstate the group. But it's really, when we're talking about how this issue plays out on campus, very rarely is it actually questions of hate speech and speech that on its face is like outright bigoted and anti-Semitic. It's mostly this mundane kind of like traditional forms of expression by political groups of leaflets, die-ins, civil disobedience, protests like that. Beyond the student group expression as well, there are countless examples of student government resolutions. One of the new tactics that student groups have adopted is calling for various forms of disinvestment or boycott by universities related to the occupation. And so we've had a number of cases where, I'll use DePaul University as an example. In May of this year, students posed a referendum to their campus. The question was, do you think that DePaul should follow socially responsible investment practices and divest its funds from companies that profit from Israel's discriminatory practices and human rights violations? 3,000 students voted, almost 3,000 students, and it passed with 55% of the votes. But the entire referendum was marred with claims that the question itself made Jewish students feel targeted and unsafe and intimidated on its face. Earlier this year at UC Santa Cruz, actually, there was a student government resolution passed calling for similar disinvestment measures. And what I think is a very unusual move, the university chancellor, George Blumenthal, sent a letter to the student commissioners who are reconsidering the vote, writing, quote, "However unintentional, its passage may create an environment in which some of our Jewish students feel alienated and less welcome on our campus." So this rhetoric is actually echoed in a number of different settings. In the UC system itself, before the resignation of President Udoff, there was a report known as the Campus Climate Report, published in July 2012, I think, which made the same conclusion, saying that pro-Palestinian, quote, anti-Israel speech on campus created an unsafe and uncomfortable environment for Jewish students on campus. There are a number of serious problems with the assumptions in this discourse. One that I think is probably one of the most harmful is the conflation between Jewish identity and a particular political opinion with respect to, in this case, the State of Israel. I think everybody in this room knows, everybody involved in this movement on whatever side knows, that the Jewish community does not have a monolithic point of view on this issue. Far from it, a number of progressive elements of the Jewish community are very active in criticizing the Israeli occupation and advocating different viewpoints. So whether you're talking about Jewish students and their point of view about this issue or any other student on the basis of their ethnicity or religion, it's a very dangerous road to create an create a direct jump from whatever that identity is to a very specific political opinion. Another important problem with this is that it assumes that all Jewish students on campus react in the same way to that expression on campus. And in fact, that's just not borne out. There was actually a recent study prompted by the campus climate reports by a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz in the psychology department named Ella Ben-Hagai, who actually did a survey of Arab and Jewish students around the UC system and concluded that the only significant predictor for negative encounters of Jewish students with Arabs and Palestinians was a lack of acknowledgement of the Palestinian narrative on the conflict. Importantly, attachment to Israel did not serve as a significant predictor for having negative or positive encounters. So even those students who do feel an attachment or identification with the state of Israel empirically don't, that does not predict whether or not their encounters with other people who have different opinions are going to be positive or negative. Another problem with that discourse is it assumes that pro-Palestinian expression on campus has only a negative impact on campus, and there's nothing positive to be gained from it. So having students from different backgrounds, students of different political persuasion exposed to different opinions is something that should be seen as an inherent good in that context, but it's denied in that context. Also, the conflation of expression of a political opinion with actionable harassment or intimidation. That, I think, is what leads to these overly punitive responses from administrators, where if you're merely saying something, not even directed towards a student's particular person, not even based on some characteristic about that person, but just a general political point of view, then that all of a sudden becomes harassment on its own. And finally, and what I think is the most serious and why it's important for people who don't have a partisan position on the underlying issue to take a point of view, is that it totally fails to consider the ramifications of these arguments in other contexts. So limiting to this issue, it doesn't consider the issue in reverse. So it's taken for granted that expressions of support for Israel on campus are just part of a benign, normal campus landscape rather than something that maybe somebody disagrees with on campus and might make them feel uncomfortable as well. Obviously, that's not a basis for censorship, but it just reveals the one-sidedness of the inquiry. And of course, if you look at it in other contexts entirely, the implication is that or the question that should be asked is, does this mean that if a Turkish student group on campus wants to have a celebration of Turkish independence or Turkish secularism, that that should be stopped because Armenian students are rightly upset about the history of the Armenian genocide in that context? I think the clear answer to that is no, but for some reason when it comes to this issue, it's harder to get that to come out of people. I also want to talk briefly about some faculty attacks, both upcoming and present. So last week, two organizations, including the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and a California-based group called the AMCHA Initiative, published white papers concerning Middle East Studies area programs that are funded by Title VI of the Higher Education Act. And the report, if you read them, the Brandeis Center's report claims these academic centers are, quote, hostile to the United States, the West, and Israel, which is a very subjective political label and has nothing to do with academic critique of methodology or anything like that, but it's simply based on, it's an ends-oriented criticism and also one that's extremely subjective. They say that the programs, quote, are not working as an effective pipeline to intelligence and national security agencies. So this is all part of a climate inviting Congress in the upcoming reauthorization of the Higher Education Act to take a step further and create enforcement mechanisms. This is what they're asking, enforcement mechanisms for a diverse viewpoints requirement under the Higher Education Act. So they want it to be possible to file complaints with the U.S. Department of Education that say these programs are biased and the federal government should investigate and determine whether or not they're biased. And if they are, cut off funding completely or force them to comply in some way. They also recommend that tenure decisions in those departments be made by people outside the departments, they say, in order to avoid politicization of the process, which is actually the opposite of what that would do. And interestingly, actually, we can talk a lot about parallels in history, but they've actually drawn the parallel. And so what they cite as precedent for this move is President Nixon's efforts to reduce Title VI funding under the Higher Education Act in the 70s because, in the report, of academics' opposition to Vietnam War policies. So there's a clear line going back there, and I think that that's one of the very serious issues that's coming up at the present time that's very important for academic associations and not just the Middle East Studies Association to hopefully take a position on and try to make sure it doesn't happen. Other patterns of these complaints against faculty, am I cutting too close? Yeah. Okay, a couple minutes. Okay. Are allegations also by a group called the AMP Initiative in California that faculty members who have expressed support for academic boycotts of Israeli institutions are misusing taxpayer funds because they are using the name of their public university or their office in order to express that point of view. It's actually an incoherent argument when you look at it, because in the same letter where they announce this, they praise university presidents for issuing statements condemning academic boycotts. So if anything, university president is relying on the name of the university for support much more than an individual faculty member is. But, you know, they're both different issues related to ability to express that. I also want to highlight one very important issue that's taking place at San Francisco State University, where the same group in California, the AMP Initiative, has called on the California State Controller to investigate a professor's use of university funds that funded her travel to the occupied territories. She was a professor who was hired in the Ethnic Studies Department to study Palestine and the Palestinians. And when she went there, she interviewed individuals from numerous different political factions, including those considered by the U.S. to be terrorist organizations. So this organization launched an attack calling it a taxpayer-funded terror tour and asked for an investigation by the California State Controller. My understanding is that the university itself has decided to conduct an audit of her travel expenses related to this issue, and that it has also denied her a request for funding for an upcoming trip that was also planned to conduct similar research. So this goes a lot towards what Professor Reichman raised as one of the first issues in academic freedom, which is the freedom to research. You can't have professors worried about investigation based on the direction that they take their research in, or the issues that they decide to research, or the people they decide to talk to in their research. How reliable can you have a study about Palestinian society, which is that professor's job, if she can't actually talk to people in Palestinian society? So I'll stop there, but thank you. Yeah.
Okay, at this point we'll move into questions, and Margie here will be passing the mic, and please remember 2 minutes.
You select the people. That's your job. I don't do that.
There's an issue of academic freedom. I'd like to hear the panelists' opinion about this with John, you teaching at the law school here. And I don't know if any of you addressed it. I was out of the room for a while. But Dean Christopher Edley, the former dean of the law school, framed this as an issue of academic freedom, that John Yoo shouldn't be investigated or dealt with or held to account for what we feel are crimes he committed while he was working as a lawyer for the Bush White House and the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, writing opinions saying it was okay to waterboard people and so forth. We know that a large number of student and faculty and staff would like to see some accountability, and the community would as well. Berkeley City Council passed a resolution asking for an investigation and firing. Students here have petitioned the university. We feel it's incorrect to characterize that as academic freedom issue, since he was working as a lawyer during the time he wrote these memos and committed the crime of conspiracy to torture, complicity in torture. What is your opinion of that? Thank you.
Well, as much as I disagree with Professor Yoo, and as much as I wish that Berkeley, where it's not my undergraduate alma mater, it's my graduate alma mater, didn't have him on the faculty, I think he does have academic freedom. I think he has the right, if you point out, you say he was not doing it as a professor, he was doing it as a lawyer, but that's exactly the question of extramural expression, that a faculty member who engages in political activity outside of the classroom, outside of the university, should be entitled to protection under the law. Now, if John Yoo's actions in the Justice Department should have been investigated and should have been acted on by government agencies is another question. I understand. Well, no, I understand that if the Justice Department didn't bring charges, I may disagree with that. I don't know enough about the facts to make a big deal, but I, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I disagreed with that. But that's not the same as the universities. And I think, that, again, the question becomes is applying the principle more broadly. Because I, in general, by the way, that calls from outside political agencies to on universities or colleges to punish faculty members who have views that those outside political agencies, whether the Berkeley City Council or any other organization or the Republican Party, for that matter, by and large, in my experience over my whole lifetime, have generally been, if we accede to those, the main victims are those on the left, not on those on the right.
I think this also relates to the issue. Sorry?
Yeah, I know. I understand, but the question is not what the Department of Justice should have done, did do, or for that.
The question is whether the university should continue to employ somebody who's convicted of a war crime.
Well,
yes, and it's not an
that's the question.
But.
Well. Okay. Oh. Look, we can disagree. That's fine. My opinion is, frankly, this is not my opinion. Is that this is a question of academic freedom? It doesn't. Well. Wait a second, because this is. I see no difference, frankly, in the argument you're making, other than the fact that when in the 1950s they said, "Well, it's been proven that communists have been convicted, etc." Communists don't actually have freedom of speech because they have to follow the rules of orders from Moscow. So therefore, they should all be fired.
Well, Nazi lawyers were hanged at Nuremberg.
Okay. Who wants to jump in over here?
I guess I'll just say something because I feel torn about that. But I agree that it is an issue of academic freedom for precisely, if you remember, one of the examples was the former Weather Underground man who was fired, right? So, there are other, it's not that I disagree that it's not a horror that he teaches here, but there are so many other political acts one could do. Students could boycott his classes. Yes, I know, but some still take him, right? And colleagues could, do a kind of shunning, right? There are lots of things that you could do to demonstrate your horror without attacking academic freedom.
Okay, let's stop there. The gentleman in the far back.
On the facts. Basically, the thing, what I have to warn you guys about, and this is all I'm going to say on it, is that you're creating a tool that Fox News will love, and they will use it against a lot of professors that you already love. And it will result in a lot of professors you like getting fired. It also overturns Sweezy.
Hi, I'm Ian Saxton. I'm a graduate student on strike. I was involved in Occupy Cal both in November 2011 and also, really we've been keeping the neo-Occupy Cal thing going all along, putting up our tent on Sproul when the anniversaries come around, going to the events and heckling the chancellor as they leave about the beating. We went, when Bergino left last May, we went to onto the steps there and brought out a 10-foot police baton, walked out. I put my tent down on the middle of the plaza as they sang an eerie a cappella outro. And, then my friends who were playing police officers beat me to death. And that was my way of, atoning for missing the beating. I went to class. I walked down to Bank of America on November 9th, 2011. And then I was like, I think I'm just going to go to my computer music educational class. And that's important to me as well. that's the personal side of the introduction. But the question is about the threats to people like me and to faculty who stand up and are really radical and saying, you know, we need immediate, you know, income equality, and we need demilitarization of our campuses especially, and certainly of our police departments, and, you know, full audits of all the corporate activity. Just our radical reconsidering big questions, There's a huge amount of surveillance and active intervention. You know, I've been put through the Santa Rita ringer, and I've had police intimidation, you know, tens of times. I think this is a red light school. I don't think it's yellow. And Napolitano's presence here, who was Homeland Security chief or secretary, as you know, who essentially really carried on Bush's oppressive military policies on the border and abroad, is it's despicable. And I guess I'm wondering, aren't you guys really, really worried about the way things are going? And I think this Dirks thing, the scandal, actually points to the fact that he's much more conservative than anyone had thought. And I think a lot of people have been pandering to him, and I don't believe in his leadership anymore.
Yeah. Well, I guess ultimately, you know, like if you're talking about, like, am I concerned about the way things are right now? It partially comes from the fact that I've never thought things were that great to begin with. So yeah, free speech has always been under threat. It's and some of the Sweezy opinion that I mentioned that you really don't want to undermine came out. It was an opinion that basically established the connection between First Amendment and academic freedom in 1957, and it was a professor who was saying that, you know, we need bloody communist revolution, and basically you would constantly tell people you'd be the first with your backs against the wall type stuff, the kind of stuff that, you know, that would be a fire case these days. So, yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Cool.
I just want you reminded me of the corrective memo that Dirks followed up with his civility, where he describes Berkeley's identity as, namely, our unflinching commitment to free speech. And it seems to me the history of Berkeley is nothing but flinching. Yes?
There's a lot of flinching going on.
If you get together into a People's History Report of Cal activism and its suppression.
Yeah. It is funny how much they do take advantage of the history in which they weren't exactly bathed in glory and saying, it's like, oh, it's like we did this. It's like, no, you didn't.
The administration said they loved this free speech movement. Anniversary, they're so proud of the tradition. Bullshit.
Yeah, I know. And then they come up with a memo saying, and now just be nice, boys and girls.
Shall we move to the next question?
Thank you.
Okay, I think there, and then this woman in green down here.
Oh, No.
He's first.
I won't get into this whole John Yoo thing because it's a semi-involved debate. But given that I understand he was teaching constitutional law,
yeah.
I mean, would we have someone who took actions as a mass violator of human rights be a professor in peace and conflict studies? So, and as I said on the facts, I think you guys are just wrong, and there's not enough time to go into it now. So, excuse me for that. I just wanted to say to the fellow next to the moderator, I'm sorry I forgot your name, I believe you do have a right not to let your group or organization be misrepresented while still allowing other people to hand out their literature. And to Professor Langan, I would like to say that you probably know this and other people do too, but you got a very small parallel taste of exactly how even non-armed, non-violent, non-resistant, even complying black males are commonly treated by the cops. Some black people have even been shot and killed, unarmed, unresistant, complying, shot and killed, complying with the orders of the cops. And in some cases, only a few blocks from returning home. So the casualness.
Of course, the civility of the cop who begins to say, get the fuck on the sidewalk, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. And I've been a victim of these things, too. On this issue of civility and making certain people uncomfortable, I'm sorry, I believe the gentleman on my right, I forgot your name, but has addressed part of this. But I'll add to it, and I don't want anyone who's not tenured to respond to me. The Israel lobby could have written what Chancellor Dirk wrote. The U.S. government and certain university chancellors are indeed taking a lacunic PR stance on this, and not even a so-called liberal Zionist, of which there are many in Israel and in the United States, their stance on this, and as the fellow on my right responded. You know, this is a new attack on suppression of free speech, on or off campus, on or off the job, even if you don't represent the campus administration or the faculty, is because of the growing new anti-apartheid movement against Israel. The Israel lobby, I'm not talking about the Jews, because there's some Zionists who want to conflate it into that, controls the U.S. Congress, even the U.S. president, and now it wants to control the students, faculty, and the campus itself. And even students who haven't been active in pro-Palestinian issues object to that. And the last thing I want to say is, you know, I find it sad when, because I've complained about censorship on the left, there have been certain members of even SJP on this campus who have tried to limit or quash free speech by members of the left, about the left, including about people who are sort of leftist heroes like Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein, and Steven Zunis. And once when I was at USF at an Arab Spring lecture, rally, whatever, and I attempted to point out that Steven Zunis declared himself to be a Zionist, the students who didn't want to believe that, these were largely Arab students, even physically attacked me for saying that. So we have to have principles of free speech, whatever side on the left we take, so that these icons don't get to engage in manufacturing their own consent in order to save Israel, because Zionism poisons everything that lets itself come into contact with it.
Thank you. Woman in green down here.
Yeah. Here I come.
Well, listening to this whole panel, I was going to ask Hank, I do have a question for you. But as I listen to everybody, things just went from bad to worse. We do have free speech at all anymore. It's pretty horrible. In any case, you mentioned those four freedoms that people have on campus. One of them was freedom of intramural. Okay. So you would think from those that people would have the freedom to criticize policies that are happening on campus.
They're supposed to.
But then you said someone did, and that was unprotected. And I'm specifically concerned because of things going on campus here and people being afraid to maybe align themselves with groups that are critical of policies happening here on campus.
Let me clarify that. In 2006, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision in this case, Garcetti v. Ceballos. It involved actually an attorney in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office who had spoken out publicly in a newspaper op-ed about what he thought was a mishandling of a case by the DA's office. And he was then punished for that. He sued. And the suit goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, the issue isn't Ceballos, C-E-B-A-L-L-O-S. And the issue is not the facts of the case yet, of whether he was punished for this or that, but whether they even had whether he had the right to sue, saying that my First Amendment right to speak out was violated. And the Supreme Court ruled that in this case, that he was acting as an employee and therefore did not have the rights he would have had as a private citizen to speak out. Now, I don't think that's a particularly good decision for public employees generally, but you can immediately see the danger to professors at public institutions. And Justice Souter saw that in his dissent, and as a result, in the majority opinion, there's a line that says, we do not need to consider today whether this applies to faculty members in universities. Well, that leaves carte blanche to the lower courts to decide for themselves whether it does. And some courts have decided that, indeed, it does apply. So, for instance, my friend Phil Cole, who is a physicist at Idaho State, was the chair of the Academic Senate there, attempted to send a message to all the faculty at Idaho State that was critical of the administration. They had a lot of conflicts with the administration there. And he sent it by email, and they refused. They wouldn't let it go through the email, and they revoked his email account. He sued, saying that it violated his free speech rights, and the court in Idaho ruled that no, Garcetti applies. He was acting as an employee. The employer could tell him what to do. Now, the good news is that other courts have said, no, this shouldn't apply to faculty, most notably for people in California. The Ninth Circuit ruled in a case that Garcetti does not apply to faculty speech as employees. Kayishian does. Now, Kayishian is a decision where a school teacher spoke out about public schools in the community. And it's a much older case from the 60s, right, from 1968, I think it was 67. 65. 65. Okay, I'm off, you know.
Is that what you have to bring for
me? Yes. So in the Ninth Circuit, which includes California, Garcetti does not apply to faculty. Unless it finally goes back up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court makes another lousy decision.
Yeah, and just to amplify on that, like we actually gave – we worked with the AUP on this one. We gave all the research we were doing it because it's just such a poorly – it's a poorly thought out, poorly worded opinion that's having really negative consequences. But also there's another bright spot, the Fourth Circuit, which usually finds a way of finding for the state. Like people try to figure out whether they're liberal or conservative or like whatever their political – no, it's like they want to figure out what the state wants to do and they want to do their work for them is basically the way you usually understand the Fourth Circuit. But even the Fourth Circuit said that it doesn't apply to faculty speech. So there's some bright spots, but it's committed havoc on sort of the legal landscape for speech that that you could once be absolutely certain would be protected.
Next, the plaid shirt down here. I promised him next.
Oh, okay.
And then yes, this person okay. Right here. Then the blue shirt, and then we can go up to the orange shirt. Sorry.
thank you. I have a very unsophisticated question, and my sensibilities are quite old. During civil rights, for example, one of the fraternities here made a point of flying the Confederate flag. And as I'm sitting here listening and agreeing 100% in terms of academic freedom, I still have to think, well, there must be some things that are not allowed. Would you allow a professor, for example, to erect a burning cross to manifest his opinion of things and so on in the world, or a troop to go around with Ku Klux Klan costumes? And I'm assuming the answer is no, that wouldn't be allowed, but I'm not understanding how can you draw a line and not allow some things and still allow almost everything that we have to allow.
I just find your assumption kind of strange, because basically the system that we're advocating is a system in which people stop that speech by moral suasion, by counter speech. And it's funny because like the KKK scenario is something I deal with all the time. It's like, what about all the KKK clubs that are trying to start on campuses? I'm like, there aren't a ton of KKK clubs that are trying to start on campuses because they know it's an incredibly unpopular opinion. And so there's a lot of times, and this worries me about people who came from the free speech movement, is that they got into power at universities, and now amazingly they trust in power and not in the system of back and forth. Because in a lot of cases, when people do engage in horrible racist speech, they are rightly ostracized for that, but that's the free speech system working. As soon as you start trusting power to take charge of this, they start not coincidentally using it against opinions they simply dislike. As you're seeing, in the example of all of those are abuses of Title IX. All of those are abuses of things that we normally think of as good.
Sure. Yeah. I want to make a distinction, first of all, between faculty expression in the classroom and faculty expression as citizens. So, for instance, to give an almost absurd example, if I want, as a history professor, I come to believe, because I'm getting senile or something, that the moon is actually really is made of green cheese. Right. And I put all my organizing efforts that I've spent my life doing now to organizing the green cheese movement. And I'm making an idiot of myself, right? But I am totally justified. The university should not take any action against me. However, were I an astronomy professor, and were I now teaching an astronomy class that the moon is made of green cheese, my colleagues, and I want to stress my colleagues, not necessarily the administrators, in the astronomy department would and should be justly concerned Now, how they dealt with that would be perhaps sometimes they probably try to get me some help or something, but whatever. But they may well then come to a point of we cannot no longer have him, even though he has tenure. And then there would be a due process procedure with a jury of my peers where I would have rights to right. say, to make my stupid case that the moon really is made of green cheese, whatever. So, now it's a little more complicated, of course, in non-science, not physical science things that are provably that same opinions, etc. But it's the same principles. So, for instance, I was in the Cal State system. For many years, one of the engineering departments at Cal State Long Beach had on their faculty a Holocaust denier. And he was an anti-Semite. And he had his own website in which he promoted Holocaust denial. And he was kind of known for this, and it was an embarrassment to his colleagues. But he never taught it in engineering classes because, well, it's not a topic for engineers, for one thing. But it never came. And what did the department do? The department on their website put up a statement that simply said, we recognize that our colleague so-and-so has controversial views on the Holocaust. These are his views and his views alone and should not reflect on the department, any other of his colleagues, or the university, period, and that's it. And never any punishment for this person. No, they ever go to the administration and stuff. And I want to stress, these are both cases where I'm talking about my hypothetical with the green cheese and this real one, where the appropriate handling is by the colleagues, by the faculty. And this goes to the point that I think both Celeste and Greg made earlier that it's very important, is the corporatization, the bureaucratization of the university, the metastasizing of administration and of professional administrators, as opposed to the old days where ever rarely now where faculty come up, they serve a while as dean, they come back down, etc. That process has led to something that removes power from the faculty. The faculty won't always handle their power correctly. We'll make mistakes. We do. But I'd much rather trust it to the faculty than to this bureaucratic administrative machine increasingly beholden to corporate donation, to political, ass-kissing, to use a technical term, what have you.
Let
him respond and then the blue shirt. Yeah.
I kind of wanted to write off that point about deference to faculty, and I think that highlighting some of the salient aspects of the Salida affair really highlight the vulnerability that academic institutions are at right now to outside pressures, and a lot of that is not out of necessarily a nefarious motive or anything like that, but just the reality that universities are underfunded and the funding systems that they've now developed are in some ways require, or you can see why an administrator is reacting in a certain way to those pressures. So in the Salida case, and I think the best reference on this is Corey Robin, a professor at Brooklyn College who's been documenting this very carefully, but all the critical decisions in that case were made between July 21st and August 7th of this year. So it took 13 days to go from a faculty appointment into a complete reverse phase. July 22nd, Chancellor gets an email. Having been a multiple six-figure donor to Illinois over the years, I know our support is ending as we vehemently disagree with the approach this individual, Dr. Salida, espouses. That same day, the university's response is, faculty have a wide range of scholarly and political views, and we recognize that the freedom of speech rights of all our employees. Within 2 days, another email from Chancellor Wise. Let me say that I just recently learned about Stephen Salida's background beyond his academic history, and I'm learning more now. July 24th, she meets with another donor who turns out to be a $500,000 donor to the university. He gave me a two-pager filled with information on Stephen Salida and said how we handle the situation will be very telling. The final decision that the university made to rescind the offer was actually made before any of the academic faculty were consulted in the university, and without even the associate chancellor who initially recommended the appointment to the chancellor weighing in. So the initial statement by the associate chancellor in the chancellor's office was, after closely reviewing Dr. Steven Salaita's dossier, I support the Department of American Indian Studies' request to grant him the rank of associate professor with indefinite tenure. The uniqueness of his scholarship on the intersection of American Indian, Palestinian, American Palestinian experiences presents a rare opportunity to add an esoteric perspective on indigeneity to our cultural studies program on campus. So how did, within a span of 13 days, all of this get undone, a process that had taken almost a year's time? And that, I think, speaks to the total vulnerability of the university as it has developed over the past few years, and can't be resolved with reliance on the First Amendment alone. Like, we have a lot of important questions to ask ourselves about how to make our university administrators have some backbone, and how to make our universities less vulnerable to this kind of outside political, financial interference. The Board of Trustees, who are not educators, should not be the people deciding who is competent to teach. Yeah.
Thank you. Let me just add one quick thing, and that is that some of us here on the UC Berkeley campus with Stanford and UC Santa Cruz are coordinating a Steven Salaita lecture series in the West. And as far as I know, the last I heard, we're getting small contributions from various programs and departments. But as far as I know, the date that he will be giving a lecture here at Berkeley is November 13th. So be on the lookout for that and come here for yourselves. Okay, blue shirt.
Okay, thank you. Hello. Okay. I've got two quick comments regarding my dear colleague and friend, Hank Reichman, who I have known for many, many years. He, like me, we are both retired professors from Cal State East Bay. A couple of quick comments and then a question, which you can answer, Hank, and perhaps others might also. Okay, first of all, on any college campus, one of the highest honors colleagues can pay to each other is to elect them chair of the Academic Senate. That's a faculty vote.
Not here? We don't elect our faculty senate chair.
Well, Cal State East Bay does. Anyway, in the history of Cal State East Bay, there are two professors who have been honored with being elected chair of the Senate three times. Both of them are the history department, which means that, yeah, I believe in STEM too, but it's nice that history has some respect. That's great. They were both personal friends. Judy Stanley was three times chair of the Academic Senate, and Hank Reichman was three times chair of the Academic Senate, and it was indeed my pleasure to vote for his election and reelection. That's something very precious to me.
I didn't pay for this, by the way.
The other thing I'd say about him is, because he is a specialist in Russian history, I wonder if the Russian history background, in a sense, motivates in some way, because of or in spite of that specialty, his passion for academic freedom. Because Russia has a history regarding academic freedom that I think would make this look like paradise. But that's another question. Here's my real question for you, Hank, and others can join in if they wish. I had never heard of the Salaita case. I didn't know a thing about it. It sounds to me, from what I am hearing for the first time, that Salaita's case is an old-fashioned case of censorship. It's not even like these controversial cases that we're discussing here. What about this guy? What about that guy? We can have different opinions, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I know you're wearing the mask, but we can have different opinions on that. Strikes me that a old-fashioned case of censorship, dear God, do those things still happen? There's one question. And then the question that goes with that, and given Hank's position with the AARP, which I respect immensely. Sorry about that. Maybe both.
My position with the AARP is just the discount, you know.
Right, that given his position with the AARP, which I respect immensely, in the old days, if the AAUP censured a university, number one, it was based on clear-cut violations that everybody could pretty much agree with, and censorship was a very, very serious thing. Does that even exist anymore?
Okay, let me say a couple of things real quickly about the Russian history background, because it gives me an opportunity to say it's not specifically the Russian history background, but my mentor and and teacher in Russian history was Reginald Zelnick, who those of you who Berkeley will know was one of the leading people in the free speech movement, even though he was already an untenured first year assistant professor, and it's that kind of courage. And if there's anything in Russian history that has inspired me to this work, it's Reggie. With respect to the thing, does old fashioned censorship still exist of this work? Yes. Greg ran down some. I could run down others. Between the two of us, we could probably keep you here until like 3 in the morning telling you stories from both about students and faculty. I think that simply highlights the fact that freedoms are never won or guaranteed. They're always fought for. And it's an unending fight. As for the AAUP censure list, we still have it. It is a lengthy process. Only the annual meeting in June can place an institution on censure, and only the annual meeting can remove them from the censure list. A censure list currently has about 63 institutions on it. Some have been on there for a long time, and they obviously have no interest in getting off. Others get on, a new administration comes in, and they try to get off, and we work with them. Louisiana State is one that we're about to probably remove. I can say about the University of Illinois, our censures are always preceded by a thorough investigation. I will say off the record, but in this audience I feel comfortable saying it, is that I think it is extremely likely that we will be investigating the University of Illinois, not only around the Salida case, but also around the Kilgore case, and more broadly by the statements by Chancellor Wise and by Chair of the Board of Trustees Kennedy, which essentially apply a standard to all cases, which is completely opposed to AAUP standards. The only reason we have not initiated such an investigation is, as a matter of practice, we try to let local remedies proceed. There is a committee of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign Academic Senate, Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, and even though that Senate is, to put it colloquially, led by suck-ups, again, another technical term, that committee isn't. And they are in the process of doing investigation, and we are waiting, but we will not wait forever for them to complete their investigation, and then we will either initiate ours or use theirs as the basis for a recommendation for censure if it proceeds. And again, but that actually would only happen in June at the annual meeting. That's the way we do it.
The orange shirt had to leave, I guess.
Okay. I just have a very short question. Carrie Nelson, the former head of AAUP, is not of this opinion. I would like to know why. That's my question.
You would have to ask Carrie, basically. I know Carrie well.
Yep.
And Carrie has done many great things for AAUP, many great things for others, but Carrie disagrees with this, and he was quoted immediately the first day this was reported in Inside Higher Ed, and Rudy Fichtenbaum, the president of AAUP, and myself immediately had to put out a public statement saying he does not speak for us. As I was quoted once, I said both Carrie Nelson and Stephen Salida have the freedom of speech. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to agree with either of them. And Carrie is a member of our Committee A. We are not about to do witch hunts when people disagree with the committee by kicking them off or anything, but I will say that his views on this do not represent those of the AAUP. His particular position has been that had he already been hired and been tenured, then this would have been a violation. He should have had a hearing. But since he hadn't formally been hired, and our experience, frankly, is, and there are numerous cases going back to well before the free speech movement, even, in fact, where we have considered cases where people have been told they were hired, brought on, and then the unhired because of the so-called final approval, and we have said, sorry, that's a summary dismissal. That's a formality. And so You know, and in fact, Chris Kennedy's even mentioned this. He said at one point in an interview, he said, well, only in very, very rare cases does the Board of Trustees get involved in faculty matters. Well, if it's in very, very rare cases, then obviously that means that the standard of bringing before the Board of Trustees an appointment is not, is a
rubber stamp.
Rubber stamp. It's a normal, you know, it's not controversial. So that's the point on which, you know, we disagree with Carrie.
So
I was thinking
basically taking the legalistic
one quick
point.
Thing, and that is that I don't know Carrie Nelson personally, but I was elected a year or so ago to the Delegate Assembly of the Modern Language Association, MLA. Went to my first meeting last year, and on the floor was the resolution to boycott Israeli universities, cultural institutions, not individuals. Carrie Nelson led the charge to try to shut that meeting down, to silence people. He was, I know this is partly tactics that all sides use, but his tactics were basically to defame the persons who were in support of the resolution. And it, by the way, if you compare it to the American Studies Association, I'm also a member there, it was a pretty meek resolution. It was pretty gutless, and to have such passion unleashed against it in such a kind of linguistically violent way was pretty shocking. So when I saw his name attached to the Salida case, I was not too surprised. So, but the woman in black over on the far side. 5 minutes.
I just have a couple comments in listening to this. Is really highly interesting. But I think, you know, we always have to look up. And when we're talking about free speech and how it should be applied to everyone, we have to look up and see, you know, what kind of a world we live in and what kind of country we live in. And it does matter that we live in a country that was founded on genocide and slavery and has continued in that tradition, you know, whatever. So part of what I would say is, so then the laws that apply to academic freedom end up with the war criminal John Yoo responsible for the deaths of people, you know, being defended and lauded at UC Berkeley, and the people who would decry the massacre of Palestinians being fired and crushed, the people who would talk about the history of Native Americans being fired. And I just think that's always something really important to look at, is that, yeah, you can say free speech and these laws and they'll apply for every, and the academic, blah, 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 but people have to have courage to look up and look when these massacres are actually going on, as they are, and look at people who represent the powers that be. There, I guess I'd say that one thing about the free speech movement was it came out of the Freedom Summer movement, which people who did that decided it's not right for some people to be oppressed and others not to do nothing. And I think that that's more fundamental than everything being applied fairly and everybody having their say, because in a situation that is fundamentally unjust and biased, that will end up with the Finkelsteins and the Salidas being fired and ruined, and people like John Yoo being given free rein to say whatever he wants and continue, because he's backed up by the powers that be. You know, that's what I would say.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, but hold on. You know what? I've made a huge mistake. I thought we were ending at 5, and I understand we were supposed to be ending at 4:45. So, Celeste, you get the final question.
Oh, well, I just actually wanted to hear what my other panelists say about the heckler's veto, because actually in relation to what you're saying, I mean, I think one fair act of civil disobedience is on college campuses to exercise the heckler's veto against speakers who are brought in by moneyed powers, you know, because it's no longer a question of, we have to hear their opinions. These people are chosen not by faculty, you know, often by administrators who run centers, et cetera. So I was just wondering if you have any opinion on that.
I've never heard anybody call it the heckler's veto and then say it's a great idea. I despise the heckler's veto. I think it works against minority opinions. And I think a lot of what you were actually saying was that free speech isn't applied fairly enough, and that's actually what we should strive towards. What you're saying is the game is rigged. The idea is that the game shouldn't be rigged. So really what we're constantly doing is try to hold people to an ideal, and what you're saying is we're not living up to it, which I agree, but that's one of the reasons why people like me have a job to try to keep on doing this. But without the ideal, it's just going to coalesce in power even worse.
All right, we have to conclude. I want to thank our panelists and thank all of you for showing up.